So this is kind of the culmination of the course, which is ultimately, now that we've built an understanding of biology of these amphibians, and we've talked about a fair amount of ways that humans can affect their populations. Now let's talk in a negative context. Let's talk about how we may positively influence their populations, conserve their populations, or even do active management from a wildlife perspective, managing, well, we'll get into that, managing the populations, okay? So, that's the goal of the lecture, is to get you all familiar with some, not all, but some conservation and management strategies for amphibians. Reading assignments, there's three there that are on the long list of reading assignments, and Jared actually asked me if I would highlight for the test review, if I would highlight papers that we should really kind of focus on, since there's like 24 listed. And I will do that, meaning that the ones that are overlapping with lectures and stuff, I will probably not focus on as much as ones that are on there that we didn't really cover. And again, we had some topics and things like that we were unable to get to this year. So those, there's some papers that are very unique, and I'd like you to get that experience. So I'll do that with the test review, which I'll try to have done by Thursday, but it might not be until Friday or something like that. So, okay. Then there's the handouts, of course, that y'all picked up, and I'll refer to those through the lecture. So this first part here is something that y'all should be able to do by now, and that is really to kind of think in your mind and summarize aquatic and terrestrial needs of amphibians in general. And so we'll rehash that going back to the, kind of through the semester. And then we'll talk about, of course, there are at least with most amphibians, they require and depend on both the aquatic environment and the terrestrial environment. And nearly all amphibians within the United States, that's true. So we'll talk about how we may focus on, you know, the aquatic environment, terrestrial environment to manage and conserve. Talk about the importance of wetland buffers, which is one conservation technique that is used. The importance of small wetlands, and talk a little bit about the influence of roads. Okay, and some conservation approaches. All right, so aquatic and terrestrial needs here. Aquatic environment. And then we have the terrestrial environment, right? So, now, I want you all to actually think about this and write this down. What are some life cycle events that occur in the aquatic environment and in the terrestrial environment? Okay, go ahead and take a few moments here. And write them down, because at this point you should be pretty comfortable at kind of thinking about, and just think about the typical life cycle of a salamander or an anuran, and what's going on in the aquatic environment, what's going on in the terrestrial environment. I took a, well, that's nice. I guess, welcome to Dell support. I don't want it. How about I just disagree? God, I hate those things. Oh, while I was working on my PhD, I don't think that we require this type of course, but I had to take a teaching course. It's a pretty interesting course, and it teaches you about different types of teaching techniques and larger classes. Not that we're that big of a class, but one of the things is the one-minute paper idea. And it's basically you ask folks, you take a minute out of the class, say, write down and reflect on this. And so we're doing the 1 minute paper idea right now. Except you can just write it down in bullets. All right, so let's think. Okay, aquatic environment. What's going on in the aquatic environment? What's dependent on it? What has to live there?
The larval stages.
The larval stages, yeah. So we have the larval stages, which include really three different stages. You have your egg stage, your embryo stage, and your tadpole stage. Okay. All right, and in order for those things to get there, what had to happen? Yeah, you had to have some. You had to have breeding going on. So the adults came down. And there's so many different types of ways that anurans and salamanders come down in courtship and things like that that we've talked about. But you need to have some breeding habitat. So we have breeding habitat. And then the aquatic environment is important for the development of eggs, embryos, and tadpoles, or I guess we could just say larvae in general, since salamander larvae are not called tadpoles. And ultimately that transitions into metamorphs, and as they go through metamorphosis. And metamorphs are still very closely tied to the aquatic environment. All right. Oh. Yeah, what else? Right? Also, the aquatic environment is used for overwintering sites for some species. Just some of the ranids will overwinter at the bottom of a wetland. Okay? Some of the ranids. Bullfrogs are one good example. And these are the juveniles, the adults. Juveniles and adults. Okay, so over here, terrestrial environment. What'd you guys write down?
Breeding.
Yeah, breeding, for example, because for a good example is salamanders that will lay their eggs and have some type of, for example, direct development or whatever. Okay?
Courtship.
Courtship as well. Breeding, courtship salamanders, and I guess I'm thinking outside of the wetland here, you know, for terrestrial environment, but in some capacity, certainly courtship even for anurans, you know, especially tree frogs will call from, and I'm still thinking temperate regions here, but they'll call in from trees close to the wetlands or ephemeral vernal pools and then come down to those pools then to deposit, well, to amplex with a female. So yeah, courtship. So we have breeding stuff, breeding habitat, which includes courtship, especially with the salamanders. Yeah, and I guess a few anurans as well. And definitely lots of anurans when we start talking about the tropics. What else?
Dispersal.
Yeah, dispersal. So you're basically your post-metamorphic activities, okay? So one of those activities is moving, right? And especially the dispersing units tend to be juveniles and going across the landscape. But you also have movements that include basically home range movements, which we'll touch on in pretty good detail here in this lecture. But you have home range movements of the adults. They're not down at the, well, for many of the species, they're not down at that aquatic environment the whole time. What else? Yeah, dispersal movements,
feeding.
Yeah, and that's a big part of the terrestrial environment is feeding, for both the adults and the juveniles. Okay, and that for the juveniles, that's the environment where they're growing. Okay, so juvenile and adults, and then we have overwintering estivation sites, just like we had. We have estivation now also. So the majority of the species are overwintering in burrows or underneath of logs or down in like a crevice or something like that. And they're estivating up in, if in, in drier times, they're estivating up in the terrestrial environment. And then, as Travis mentioned, dispersal, I think it's Travis. Was it Travis? Yeah. Did you mention that? Was that you? Yeah, with the dispersal. All right. Yeah, raise your hand. Take credit. Yeah. Okay. So, all right. Good. Good. Now, the concerns that we should have. What about the aquatic environment? When do things get bad? Well, let's just start here. Breeding habitat. All right. Well, primarily the breeding habitat is often, at least with the nerns and also, well, in a sense, in some capacity, because they often use it for overposition sites, is that shoreline vegetation. Okay, so we want to make sure that we have intact shoreline vegetation. That's also important. Those are important areas for the tadpoles, for overposition sites, but also for the tadpoles. So shoreline vegetation, right, is something we should be concerned about in the aquatic environment. What else?
Water quality,
absolutely. You know, and in particular, we've touched on a couple different things like dissolved oxygen levels, levels of various types of nitrogenous compounds such as ammonia, nitrite, and nitrate, and when those get to be toxic levels for tadpoles. Then, of course, various types of chemicals like insecticides and herbicides. What other aspect of water? We have water quality, which deals with really kind of chemical composition. Exactly. Water temperature is also an important factor. In temperate regions, usually the greatest concern is the water getting too hot. Okay, and we talked about some temperature thresholds, which will I'll refresh your memory a little bit later. So we have water quality, water temperature, and what else about water? Siltation. Yep, that's and let's throw that in with water quality as well. Okay, so it could be very turbid. One thing about turbidity is there isn't a whole lot of research that turbid conditions negatively impact. Well, there isn't a whole lot of research. So, looking at the influences of turbidity on tadpoles. Now, turbidity has been shown to have a negative effect for some species on egg survival because it interferes with oxygen transfer, can cover the eggs. Okay, so what else? We have water quality, water temperature, and yeah, that's in there, absolutely. Aquatic predators, fish, introduced species. And I'll just throw this other one in here, hydropurity, right? We've got to have water first before. So we need to have water. And the duration of that hydropurity is very critical in structuring these populations. And I'll just refresh your memory. This 2 to 3 months, across the board, you know, averaging, and for temperate amphibians, it usually takes 2 to 3 months on average for them to develop, okay, and get to metamorphosis. All right, that's on average. We have certainly some species that take less than a month, and some species that need to develop for over a year. Okay. All right, so we have fire, then we have water quality and temperature, fish, and other introduced species that. Certainly could be fish that are introduced, but other, for example, like amphibian species, like bullfrogs being introduced into the western United States, or the cane toads, or whatever, some of those species we've talked about. All right. Post-metamorphic concerns. Well, we've talked, last time I was talking, we talked about agricultural cultivation, etc. So just like we have shoreline vegetation here, well, we need intact vegetation, right, up in the terrestrial environment, whether it's a forest environment or it's a grassland environment or whatever that natural landscape should be. It's important because Why is it important to have that vegetation?
Cover.
Cover, yeah. Now, what does cover do? Does a lot.
Place from
yeah, so you have predator protection. What else does cover do?
Blocks the
sun. So it decreases the temperature. It also increases the humidity. All those things are important for amphibians who need to maintain moist skin. Okay? Absolutely. And what else does vegetation produce? What's that?
Prey.
Prey, yeah, yeah. Invertebrate foraging sites. Okay? So that vegetation structure is important. And areas, etc. So those all, this intact vegetation is all related to temperature, humidity, predators. Okay? So it's important to have things like in your forested area, decomposing logs, etc. We'll get to those, having abundant insects. And then finally, this whole idea of post-metamorphic movement and especially connectedness of disjunct populations and having areas where that are relatively undisturbed where amphibians can navigate through and connect one population to another. Okay? Any questions? All right, now that we have that all laid out there nicely and kind of summarize a good portion of the course, let's go in and talk about how we're going to ultimately, what can we do to address to ensure that these habitat needs are met? Okay, so how can we address some of these concerns here as conservation biologists or wildlife managers? All right, so let's start with the aquatic environment, and we'll go through several of these, and then we'll talk about the terrestrial environment and a few others. Okay, so shoreline vegetation, what can we do? How would shoreline vegetation be negatively impacted? If you don't draw it down. That's a very good point. In wetland management, if we have control over water levels, if you keep things very deep, that you won't have shoreline vegetation. Okay, meaning that you basically where the water starts, if it drops off very quickly and you keep it deep, you aren't going to have that shoreline vegetation development. So as a manager, you can actually manipulate the water levels, bring it down, do a drawdown, which we'll talk about in a little bit, to help establish shoreline vegetation. So water depth can certainly impact shoreline development. What's an anthropogenic thing that could reduce it?
Roundup,
yeah, absolutely. Various herbicides that wash down in, and application of those herbicides may be unintentional or intentional, meaning that might be just something that's coming off the landscape, or you might be applying herbicide because you want to control vegetation. Liz and Chandler's research? Cattle, right? Big one. And very common in Tennessee. I mean, across the board, this is probably one of the biggest ways the amphibian populations are impacted in our state is with cattle. All right, so very first thing is, and we'll get to the other thoughts that y'all brought up in just a second, they're good thoughts, but is to minimize cattle access. Now, unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of information out there. And what do I mean by minimize cattle access? But at the very least, you can put up electric fence, okay? And the question comes, minimize. Now, we could just say don't let cattle in there. But that's not going to be a very compatible land use for most Tennessee farmers. They say, well, forget that. I'm not going to do that. We need to use that wetland. And there aren't any laws against it, okay? And there aren't, okay? You can let your cattle go down into these areas. So, you know, part of being a natural resource manager is to try to conceive some type of management recommendation that isn't too inconvenient for a landowner. All right? So we can definitely restrict access with electric fence. Obviously, if we're interested in doing that, ultimately, we should offer this as some type of cost share program or just as part of a conservation program where the government, the state, or the feds pick up the cost. Currently, there isn't a program out there to do that yet, and it'll probably still take quite a few years of research to get it and lobbying to get it incorporated, for example, NRCS conservation program. Yeah. Will they? For water quality. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a good idea, though, then. We can certainly piggyback off of things like water quality and say, hey, listen, we're doing this to improve water quality and also improve amphibian habitat simultaneously. Well, that's good. Oh, that's great. I'd like to get some information on that. Yeah. Yeah.
One where we could get machinery completely across, and one where the cattle could just get down the stream in a small portion.
Okay. Yeah, and that's the other interesting thought is, and what really needs to be evaluated is what about just restricting access to just a part of the wetland? Do we have to restrict access from the entire watershed, from the entire stream, or in a pond type situation, which exists a lot in Tennessee? Can we just maybe restrict them from half of it, and that'll still provide provide some breeding habitat for amphibians? We really don't know. I mean, those are experiments that we hope to do in the future and to learn. So. Obviously, the most important time to, if we can restrict cattle, is during the breeding season, which in Tennessee runs from February through July, but we need some time here also for larvae to develop, which usually take 2 to 3 months. So February to August, you may even push that to September. But other techniques could be doing a grazing rotation. Well, this kind of works into it, okay? Maybe, you can work with farmers to have them put their cattle on late August. And when most of the breeding is done and most of the tadpoles have gone through metamorphosis. Or far along in development, that if cattle go in there and reduce the water quality, they sense that and they're far along in development as far as pre-metamorphosis to then get those cues and to go through metamorphosis to speed up development. Now, I would suggest, and this all depends on density of cattle, but I would suggest that it would be nice if we could minimize activity less than a month. Now, where does that come from? It doesn't come from anything except from personal observations of what cattle can do in about a month in a wetland. We really need to test this and come up with some realistic grazing intensity recommendations, as well as far as a density at less than 30 head per hectare. Now, this may or may not be realistic depending on how large farms are. And again, what we need to do is we need to test this so we can come up with solid recommendations. So that's what we're in the process of doing now, is trying to secure some funds to be able to make recommendations and have science backing it.
aren't most of the farms in Tennessee 90%
Yeah, they tend to be, a lot of the farms tend to be smaller anyway, so you might be able to be under the 30 head per hectare. I'm not really need to learn about that a little bit more. For the plateau Research and Education Center, where we've done our work, they have, what's their herd size? Oof, golly, I'm trying to remember now. I think it's near 2,000 head. Does anybody know? I think it's near 2,000 head. So for them to, at any given wetland, for them to have 100 to 200 head is not that big of a deal. And that's where you certainly get this type of grazing going on. That's a larger cattle operation, obviously. And there are certainly some cattle operations that are that large, if not larger, in Tennessee. But, yeah.
But, I mean, you got to think of it on the other end, too. A lot of these ponds are created by cattle water sources.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah,
well, see, that's the thing, and that's where we need to get with landowners and talk to them about this, because indeed, that would be a common response to a farmer, from a farmer, is that, you know what, I built this farm in 19, or built this pond in 1960, and these things colonized it, and well, so they're there, it's my land, I'm still going to do what I want to do, which is certainly, that's true, it is your... But yeah, hold on for 1 second. The response, though, that we need to take, Matt, is that as well. Yeah, you were in the wetland class. I probably should have a wetland just one lecture just on wetland loss in this class. But as you recall, 53% of the wetland acreage in the United States has been destroyed. Okay, so it is a very small, it's a very important ecosystem that has been decreasing over time. It's even decreasing at a faster rate now because of recent legislation that has occurred just within the last 6 years. So pretty much you can go out and you can do anything pretty much to a wetland now. Now I'll hit on a couple of those things towards the end. Have been some really influential Supreme Court decisions since the Bush administration to negatively impact wetlands. So we have less and less wetlands out there. Now, there's been research that's been done by USGS that has documented the importance of agricultural wetlands for amphibians. So what we have on the landscape is much less habitat for them, both in the aquatic environment and the terrestrial environment. We have these agricultural ponds that are providing an important ecological benefit for amphibians. And if you want to call it a surrogate habitat, then we certainly could. What we need to try to come up with is some prudent conservation and management strategies that is not an inconvenience to the landowner. It benefits water quality, multiple things, amphibians, and potentially even the health of his herd and or her herd. Amphibian conservation underneath of wetland conservation on a particular landowner's property. So,
you got any ideas yet?
Yeah, I do. I've got some ideas, and especially the big thing is connecting things into health of the herd for the farmer. And so we're doing a bunch of studies right now, which some of you guys are aware of, that is looking at amphibians being bad things in some capacity, them actually being able to be suitable hosts for different types of cattle and human pathogens, one of those being E. coli 0157H7 that you've all heard about. And some preliminary tests that we've done actually has shown that bullfrog, tadpoles, and metamorphs can be suitable hosts of that pathogen. Now, we're setting up a bunch of experiments to look at this, but what does that mean? We don't want to turn farmers against amphibians by any means, but what we want to do, what it potentially means is that tadpoles that are out there could if you have an infected, one infected cattle, come down, cow come down, or bull, whatever, come on down to the wetland and release that pathogen into the wetland, tadpoles can take up that pathogen and hold that pathogen in that system. So, for example, E. coli cannot maintain itself. It needs to be within a host. And environmental persistence right now we're testing, but it's probably around a month. So unless cattle keep getting reinfected amongst each other, which is a possibility, but there is a stringent effort to try to minimize these pathogens within herds, because not that E. coli does a whole lot to cattle, but that can be passed on, that pathogen could be passed on to humans. So anyways, to kind of bring everything together, we're approaching the cattle use, cattle land use, from both perspectives. Something that could benefit, looking at the influence of cattle on amphibians, but also looking at potentially the influence of amphibians on cattle. And by maybe creating a link in that capacity and also having the data behind it to show environmental benefits, we might be able to sell that type of a recommendation to landowners and also to a conservation program. So that's our idea, and it'll probably take us a good, you know, 4 or 5 years to collect all the data to get to that point. But anyways, that's where we're rolling. All right? So, got off on a tangent, but that was kind of a fun tangent. And then, you know, why do farmers allow access into farm ponds or into streams? And primarily as a water source, but also as a foraging source too. So they're foraging vegetation, the shoreline vegetation, etc., but they're also getting water. And if we come up with some type of conservation recommendation to keep them out of these wetlands, then certainly we have to think about providing forage or water in another location. And so conservation programs need to take that into consideration as well, whether it's just providing the troughs or drilling a well or something like that. All right. So any questions with that? All right. Now, when we have constructed wetlands, and as biologists, if you're on an area, there may be this type of infrastructure in place where you have levees and water control structures and things, and that gives you the capability to manipulate water levels, which, as we were talking about earlier, can really impact shoreline vegetation. So before I get to that, I forgot what was underneath it here. When you construct the wetland, if you happen to be constructing wetlands, which again is building up a levee to hold water back, and then that levee will have some type of water control structure to let water out or potentially let water in, constructed wetlands should not drop off rapidly. Okay, they should have a nice gradual slope to them so that things get deeper over a greater distance and shoreline vegetation can develop. As you know, Matt was indicating earlier, you know, if it just drops off quick, right, you're not going to have any shoreline development. So that gradual slope is important if you are constructing a wetland for management. What's that? Well, yeah, that's a good question. A preferred maximum depth. Yeah, no, that's right. I would say probably in Tennessee, no deeper than 6 feet. In fact, you want it shallow. You're not, and ideally you don't want fish in there either, you know. And I only say 6 feet. Now, the majority of the species are not going to overwinter, okay? But you do have some species like bullfrogs and green frogs where their tadpoles will overwinter. And so having a deeper wetland would help help provide that habitat. So I would say keep it less than 6 feet. All right, shoreline vegetation. The whole drawdown thing, I guess, is on the next one. We talk about hydroperiod. The other thing is the type of vegetation. Well, we certainly have issues with various types of exotic plants. And those things differ in structure than our native plants. And they may not be as good in habitat quality because of that type of that structure. An example here is purple loosestrife, Lithrum. And purple loosestrife gets into wetlands and grows extremely, extremely dense. And when it dies, it's really kind of almost like a woody plant. It's got a very hard stalk. And it probably, although nobody's evaluated, it probably isn't as good for amphibians. It certainly isn't good for a lot of other wetland species, wetland-dependent species, various birds and things like that. So there certainly is, there are times where you might want to control exotic plants that may invade your wetland. Well, the best way to control exotic plants, quite frankly, is with herbicides. And there are more than three categories, but most commonly used are three categories in wetlands. One is 2,4-D, and 2,4-D is a broadleaf herbicide, meaning that it targets broadleaf wetland plants. Okay, broadleaf wetland plants, not like the grasses and stuff. So one of the labels for it is AquaClean. AquaClean. Glyphosate are non-selective herbicides. And as we go down this herbicide list here, they get more and more potent. Okay, more and more effective, and also the cost generally as well. Non-selective glyphosate herbicide is Rodeo, and there's an aquatic label for Rodeo that you can use. And then Imazapyr. And Imazapyr is often used for really stubborn, the name is, the label name is Habitat. Is often used for real stubborn exotics like alligator weed, for example. Now, your first handout here, actually by Rick Relier at University of Pittsburgh. Okay, Rick has been in the spotlight for the past 3 years because he did some research that basically indicated that Rodeo kills tadpoles and kills juvenile amphibians. And he did this in a controlled setting. And Monsanto Farms, or Monsanto Incorporated, that makes Rodeo, certainly, and of course, or Rodeo. I said Rodeo, this is Roundup, my bad. Roundup's a glyphosate anyways. Roundup doesn't have an aquatic label, Rodeo does. But at any point, they're both glyphosate herbicides. So he looked at Roundup, and which is a very common herbicide on for crops, etc., and found that it negatively impacts amphibians, both tadpoles and juveniles. He also documented in that study that 2,4-D didn't have any impacts.
What's the last Roundup?
I want to say probably less than a couple of weeks. And if you look at in here, I think, well, oh yeah.
Some of them have been
short on the
space, not having time to,
yeah,
recuperate.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the life is on Roundup. I know he has it in his paper, but I don't think it's more than a month, you know. But, yeah, anyways. Yeah, it certainly, I would expect there to be some species dependence on how it would influence different types. But, anyways, you can, at your leisure, take a look at those. And I think, well, I don't think I have his papers as required reading, but the abstracts are, yeah.
Did you try to do this at a certain time of year, like maybe when there's not going to be a lot of activity in activity?
Yeah, that would be definitely a good time, except that, see, the plant's got to be taking this thing up.
Yeah.
So I don't know in fall, see, trees, you know, it's a good time to apply herbicide in the fall because they're taking all the, or mobilizing all their resources and taking it down to the root. And so that's one of the best times, the herbicide for trees. You would want to hit them, I'm saying, you know, I don't know. You definitely would want to hit it before they seed out. And because once they seed out, they're basically at that point where they can senesce. And often these herbicides are applied during the summer. Yeah, which, like when folks are applying herbicides for like alligator weed and things like that, they're applied right when tadpoles are coming. The interesting thing is, you know, with the Roundup, Rick was looking at it from an agricultural standpoint and it running down into a wetland, etc. But we actively apply herbicides over wetlands for wildlife management, and nobody has looked at the impacts of, for example, using Rodeo or Habitat and how that impacts developing amphibian larvae.
I read somewhere that said that if they found a wetland where they had no herbicide and hadn't had any pesticides applied for 25 years, and they could still test for some of it.
Oh, is that right? Interesting. Yeah, you know, I could believe it, especially, well, I would expect that in deeper wetlands that where it can bind maybe with the sediment and it's down there in an anoxic state and preventing preventing really breakdown. In wetlands that drop up, I wouldn't expect that. Okay, so the other thing that you can do is use some type of biological control. And I really kind of bring that up primarily because it's used often with purple loosestrife, well, where it's extremely dense, which is in the Midwest states and over into New York. And they use a certain evil and a beetle, and they claim these things are great, although they're exotic, just along with the plant, you know, and I have problems controlling an exotic with an exotic. But right now, these things are poster childs, and they love them up in the Midwest because they are, at least in some cases, they're very effective at reducing the amount of purple loosestrife out there. Anyways, so that's another possibility. Other questions? Oh, I would think as soon as you put water on it, you're going to have responding. Plants, you know, they'll usually respond right within a year. I mean, if you have a decent seed bank. So usually where you're building wetlands is in an area that has been a wetland before, maybe it's drained now. Well, that's what you shouldn't be building wetlands in the uplands. But if you had and you're going to have a rich seed bank there, and things will respond pretty quickly usually. Usually you don't have to do any. You could do broadcast seeding. You could buy some seeds and stuff like that. But my recommendation is first see what comes up. And within one growing season, you should see wetland plants responding. A lot of them have extremely good dispersal capability too, like cattail. That's one way you can go pick some cattail heads and go out and you know, spread seed if you want to. Okay. Any other questions? For those that are interested in wetlands, I'm teaching a wetland class, a graduate level wetland class in the fall. It's WFS 536. And it'll be taught on Tuesday and Thursday nights, just like this course, about the same time. And we talk all about wetland delineation, wetland regulations, and then get into you know, how humans affect wetlands, blah, 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 the management of wetlands, et cetera. So. No. No. You have to do a group project, a wetland delineation group project, which most folks have a lot of fun with. Now, and you have to do, there's one quantitative assignment where you're calculating carrying capacity of wetlands. Yeah, okay. Hydroperiod. So one strategy is, you know, so a lot of the wetlands, like as mentioned before, have been drained. In the United States, most of our wetlands have been, majority. So one obvious way to create water, right, in these areas, and in many of our wildlife management areas and our refuges are areas that have been purchased that used to be agricultural areas. So is to go into these areas, and basically here you have a drainage tile. Underneath there's basically it's either clay or plastic tile that goes out here where the wetland is, and it goes out, and this is a depressional wetland, it goes out to an adjacent stream body. And so one thing is to break that drain tile and just let it back up, or if it's a ditch, then actually plug that ditch up with a levee or something like that and hold water. So that's one obvious thing that you can do. Here we have obviously a farmer that's just doesn't want any water out there, and still planting right through the wetland area. All right, so to manage wetlands, okay, one of our techniques in wildlife management is manipulating the water levels. This is one type of water control structure, which is just a screw that's hooked, it's called a screw gate, has a wheel. As you turn it, it opens the gate, and you turn it another way, it closes the gate, and you let water in and out, etc. So we talk about when we're managing wetlands, again, this here is that February to August, we're talking about often creating conditions like this at certain times of the year. As a wildlife biologist, and natural resource managers in general, don't just focus on one species or one community. We manage wetlands for multiple communities. One of those happens to be amphibians, and another important community, in fact, wetland management was conceived out of managing for this community, is the water bird community. And initially it was just waterfowl back in the 60s and stuff, where that was the important game species and of interest. Now we spread things out to non-game species, which include managing for shorebirds, wading birds, amphibians, etc. So we have a lot of different species here that are using wetlands. Wetlands are the most species-rich ecosystems in the world. And again, I could go into a lecture just on that, but as a manager, you're creating these drawdowns at different times. Well, we want to create our drawdowns at different times so that they complement different species, and that may be earlier in the year for some species of water birds and later in the year for maybe amphibians. And so the drawdown schedules need to be done aware of the life cycle needs of not only amphibians but also other species out there. So that's one. Now, what is suggested and is definitely a good idea is to provide a diversity of drawdowns or a diversity of hydroperiods so that you have some wetlands that you may keep permanent. Okay? You rarely draw them down, or you draw them down maybe once every 5 years, because when you draw it down, things begin to decompose rapidly, you can have nutrient release, etc., and it can be very beneficial with respect to rejuvenating that system. So some drawdowns are really, we pretty much always do them at some time, but you can have permanent wetlands for a longer period of time and then have ephemeral wetlands. And so Joel Snodgrass is, at least from the amphibian standpoint, is one of the folks, he's over at Towson University in Maryland, one of the folks that has documented that it is good to have multiple wetlands out there with multiple hydro periods. It maximizes the number of species that you can address. In these permanent wetlands, you get overwintering in our region, you get overwintering bullfrogs and green frog tadpoles, which can nail, as we've already talked about, nail other anurans that come down and breed early in the breeding season. So, and you can get paedomorphic ambisoma larvae. that didn't make any sense. Paedomorphic ambistomids and their larvae that get established in here and really are very effective predators on later breeding anurans. So, it's good that they're not all permanent. Okay, having some that either naturally are going dry, like maybe in some forested wetland areas, or ones that you perform a drawdown at different times of the year is a good management strategy and conservation strategy. Having a diversity of wetlands, again, flooded marsh, having areas that naturally flooded forested areas are all part of really a good management amphibian management scheme. Okay.
What was the benefit of having an ephemeral wetland?
Well, because you won't have anything overwintering in ephemeral wetlands. So the idea would be to have water in the ephemeral wetlands from February till about August and then draw them down slowly. And by doing that, you can create a level playing ground for a lot of those species that do not overwinter. And you can really produce a lot of tadpoles and a lot of amphibians in fishless environments, in fishless aquatic environments that are ephemeral. Any other questions? So the other thing is when we talk about doing these manipulations, and I go into this in depth in the wetlands course, you draw them down, but of course you don't want to just open the gate up and let all the water out. This is another type of structure here called a drop board structure. It has this channel, these channel iron guides here. Boards drop down in there and you pull boards out. Well, we talk about doing gradual drawdowns, and that's important not only for amphibians but for other species. For amphibians, it's important because, and that, what I mean by gradual drawdown is by the time that wetland is dewatered, it's at least taken 2 weeks. Amphibians can sense a decrease, as we talked about, a decrease in water level, and can accelerate and move through development and go through metamorphosis. They do need to be beyond a certain threshold point, okay, from a developmental standpoint, in order to be able to do that. And for most amphibians, for most anurans, that's at least a month into development. All right, in some, it's closer to 2 months. So, anyways, when you draw down, just because of when species breed and individuals within species breed and that variability, there will be some tadpole loss. There's no question. But by drawing down, you know, in August or so, the majority of the species that are out there will be far long enough in development to go through metamorphosis and be fine. Maybe all, in fact, several will have already gone through metamorphosis just naturally. Peak metamorphic times are in June and July for a lot of our species. Okay. Let's see here. From the wildlife management perspective, having some tadpoles that get concentrated into an area and can't go through metamorphosis is not necessarily a bad thing, because, unless you have an endangered species, but because wading birds will respond, and that'll provide foraging habitat for wading birds. All right, any questions? All right. Now, next thing, water quality. We want to maintain decent water quality from a chemical standpoint, an oxygen standpoint, and a temperature standpoint. So, how do we do that? First, let's minimize our agricultural chemicals. All right. Agricultural chemicals, we're talking about pesticides, herbicides, and fertilizers. So, first and foremost, obviously, use the manufacturer's recommendations, don't exceed them. And in particular, this especially applies to when you're directly applying it to the wetland, okay? If you're trying to do some type of exotic plant control. One thing that is coming out right now by work that Rick Relier and some folks over at UC Berkeley are doing is that pesticide mixtures, okay, or chemical mixtures are much more lethal to amphibians than any individual chemical. Okay, so we're just now really getting into looking at multiple things which often occur in the real environment. You have insecticides washing down, herbicides washing down, you have fertilizers washing down, all these things coming into a chemical soup down into the bottom of the watershed, which is the wetland where amphibians are breeding. How does this affect egg survival? How does it affect embryo survival? How does it affect tadpole or larval survival? And there's some really scary initial results coming out indicating that things that are fine are applied at the manufacturer's recommendations when you, as far as being concerned as far as impacts on biological communities, are severely toxic when you put several of these things together. That is information that will be coming out and published in the next couple years. And you can imagine all the experiments you can think of your head, all the different types of chemicals that we apply to agricultural landscapes. Well, yeah. 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 Well, you know, surfactants are, yeah, an important thing. I don't know if surfactants themselves decrease the probability of it being washed down into the watershed. It probably would, yeah. So, but most farmers, et cetera, are using surfactants when it's appropriate. That's one thing that actually Rick got a little bit hammered on because he didn't put the surfactant in his test. And so that was one of the critiques. I'm not sure what he's doing with that. He's probably now has another whole group of experiments now with the surfactant in it. But the other thing that's obvious is just to, if you're applying herbicides aerially, is not to, you know, tell the pilot to, you know, turn off the sprayer, you know, before they hit a wetland. I'm not just bringing this up so that it's kind of like, well, yeah, that's what farmers should be doing, but, you know, from a natural resource management standpoint, A, we're interacting with farmers, but B, we often have farmers that are working on wildlife management areas and on refuges that are in some type of sharecropping agreement. So part of wildlife management is providing food plots and things like that for deer and turkey and waterfowl. And so working with your farmers to help minimize these potential chemical impacts on the aquatic environment are important as you're trying to manage not only for maybe certain game species and things, but also for non-game species. Okay? If you can treat, and this is more, you know, related to exotic plants in your wetland, if you can treat more localized as opposed to the entire wetland, obviously that's ideal. Minimize the impact. Now, at the very minimum, you should have a 15-meter buffer around wetlands. And that is actually the recommendation, that's TDEC's recommendation, is 15 meters. Most of the ecological community, with respect to having positive impacts on water quality that are biologically relevant, suggest 30 meters. And we'll come back to that when we talk about buffer size width in just a little bit. So establish a 15-meter buffer at least, but we'll talk about how we want that even to be a lot greater by the end. Really, research needs to look at this, is what is the effective buffer size width to maintain decent water quality? We need to look at this more. To my knowledge, there aren't any replicated studies that looked at different buffer size widths on a replicated context and applied different applications, different types of chemicals to the environment and looked at the rates of runoff into different wetlands. So a lot of the information about buffers, you can imagine trying to replicate that on a landscape. It's challenging, but that's what towards, because buffers are one conservation technique to use to improve water quality, but also conserve amphibian habitat. All right, maximize dissolved oxygen. The goal is, when you're trying to maximize dissolved oxygen, is to minimize eutrophication, because as you get into a eutrophied system, you have a lot of things that might be producing oxygen, such as algae and stuff like that, but then when it gets dark and they're continuing to respire and all the things that are feeding on the algae are respiring, you can have sharp declines in dissolved oxygen. So minimizing eutrophication. Well, how are we going to do that? Well, how does eutrophication happen on a landscape? Increase nutrients. Yeah, and it typically in you know, a landscape that we've modified, that happens through two different ways, through cattle and then also through agricultural chemicals or nitrogen fertilizers. So how are we going to minimize eutrophication? Well, this goes back to, even with the shoreline vegetation, minimize cattle access. How much? Don't know. Can't really tell you. Yeah, we need to do that work. But the other thing I do want to point out is that for most tadpole species, they can tolerate relatively low DO levels, much lower than what fish can tolerate, like less than 1 milligram per liter. That's pretty darn low. So this is generally not that big of a case from an oxygen standpoint. Okay? The other thing is that tadpoles do have lungs. They aren't very well developed, but when dissolved oxygen levels get low, they can come up and gulp air and use their lungs to some capacity. I mean, if it drops below 1 milligram per liter, they're probably going to be really screwed. But in most cases, dissolved oxygen isn't that big of a deal. So you can minimize cal access, you can minimize fertilizers by really ultimately creating buffer, some type of buffer strip, buffer zone, which we'll talk about later. I put these numbers up here. This here relates more to the chemical aspects of fertilizers, of nitrogenous compounds. And this is in the tadpole lecture, and I bring this up again to refresh your memory. And these are important levels that I would like you to remember, just like that 1 milligram per liter for dissolved oxygen. But these are toxic levels to tadpoles for 0.5 milligrams per liter is ammonia, NH3. 2 is nitrite, 2 milligrams per liter. And then 30 milligrams per liter is nitrate. And we have I think the tadpole lecture was one of the first lectures after test one, but. There's decreased survival of eggs and tadpoles, and there's also decreased growth and increased malformations in tadpoles exposed to greater levels than all of these, for all of these. Yeah.
Do you know if that would be in part promoting?
Yeah, so milligrams per liter is equivalent to, I thought it was parts per thousand. No, it's parts per million. My bad. No, it is parts per million. Yeah. So that's equivalent. So one part per million is 1 milligram per liter. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. All right. Any other questions? All right. One thing you can do in a managed wetland, if you're hitting, you see you're having eutrophied system and conditions, and maybe you go out there and you test the dissolved oxygen levels with a DO meter while we're really getting low. You can flush water into the wetland if you have a managed system and you have a reservoir, for example. Like, for example, here, if you have a reservoir as part of your management area, you can flow water into it and increase oxygen levels. Or you can even pump things. This is called a gator pump, where this is you see the water flowing out here? This is a tube. This pump runs off of your tractor, the power takeoff of your tractor, which is a thing that spins, and it connects to an axle, which goes down into the water and has a propeller. And it basically, as that PTO, as it turns, it's sucking water through that propeller up this metal shaft into this long tube, and out goes the water. So that's another way that you can move water in wetlands. A gator pump, let me see. That's a good question. Those are, I bought one back in '06. I think it was $12,000. Well, that would be another thing. You could have an aerator that floated around in a wetland. I wouldn't necessarily say that there's any benefit, that would be another thing you could do, another technique, yeah. Yeah. Well, one benefit would be decreasing the chemical concentration of these. Because as you flow water through, it's going to dilute those chemicals.
Where is the water being brought in from?
Well, if you had an adjacent reservoir or a creek or something like that, usually on wildlife management areas, they'll have something like this where they'll have a reservoir, and they can flow this water down maybe into a network of ditches, which then you can pump water in or flow water in via gravity into wetlands. It just kind of depends on the particular area and the setup that they have.
Does that stir up the organic matter?
Yeah, oh, it will. Yeah, where you're, actually where you're pumping into and where you're sucking out of, it'll definitely, you definitely don't want to back a gator pump down into an area that has a lot of organic matter. Usually there are areas that you've thought of or it's been designed where it drops off very quickly here, and this is basically like a burrow pit area where you have water. And so usually those types of things are, like this might be a levee. This is just demonstration here. This doesn't make any sense here, I should have also said, because what you're looking at is they're demonstrating. So they're pumping water out, and then they're letting it flow back in. So what you do is you pump it from this nice oxygenated thing over a levee to your dirty wetland that you have here, okay? It's sitting over here, eutrophied. And so this thing, you can actually put several sections of this, and this is flexible hose. And it comes in 30-foot sections, and you can go about 120 feet by connecting these sections together before you're really losing your gallons per minute, and it's almost not even worthwhile. Yeah, okay, so that might make a little more sense than just, pump it up here and let it flow back down. Yeah, okay, sorry. All right. Now, prevent high temperature. How are we going to do that? How are we going to prevent high temperature? Shade, that's pretty much it. By maintaining natural vegetation around our wetland. Again, I put this up as the critical regions in which you start to hit when tadpoles start to keel over. And for most of our temperate tadpoles, we're talking about anywhere from 9 degrees Fahrenheit up to 100 degrees Fahrenheit, or 34 to 42 C. This is lower for salamanders, and I'll hit that down here. So yeah, maintain or establish tree cover adjacent to wetlands, or even just shoreline vegetation, such as you have here with cattail. The water temperature out in where the sun is hitting and where these cattails are and going right down is going to be quite a bit difference. It can often be 5 degrees difference. And that's a big, that's in fact where that vegetation is, and along the shores where the tadpoles are mostly congregated in most cases, because that's where most of the food is. And in cases where you have fish out in open water areas, they're not venturing out there either. Or if they do, they don't last very long. So just having that shoreline vegetation, maintaining, establishing it, etc., through some of the techniques we've talked about, is important. For lotic systems, for creek systems, river systems, maintaining flow. Now, how do you maintain flow? Well, it rains, right? So what are you going to do? But, you know, these are things more on large watershed, for watershed considerations. Many of the flows of our streams are regulated by TVA. And maintaining that flow so that you have adequate oxygen levels and you have adequate flow levels is critical for various types of salamander species. So for salamanders, we're talking about ideal water temperatures anywhere 20 C and less, and much higher oxygen levels are necessary. So maintaining that flow is obviously an important thing, especially the plethodontid salamanders. They don't have lungs, right? You know, they're going to be really in trouble if oxygen levels drop. All right, any questions? So much for getting through today, right? I start off every time with these ambitions. Yeah. I didn't have anything to do next Tuesday anyways. I'm sure y'all didn't either, right? Okay, so let's go through. We'll probably end I don't know. Who knows? So predators. All right. Well, the main predator of amphibian populations are fish, okay? And, I mean, I would suggest in areas where fish naturally occur, well, they naturally occur. I mean, you shouldn't be trying to remove fish. But in areas where they've been introduced, you know, and you're concerned about amphibian populations, managing the fish population or eliminating the fish population is a possibility. What's one way to eliminate the fish population? To eliminate it. Rote known is one, yeah. Another is just, if you have water level control, is drain the whole thing. Okay, do it in winter when pretty much you don't have anything except your overwintering tadpoles. So with fish, all fish are going to eat the eggs. Comparing fishless wetlands with fish wetlands and the number of tadpoles that are produced and metamorphs that are produced, you can't even compare them. I mean, it's crazy different levels. I mean, we're talking literally 50 to 100 times more without fish in there. They're very effective. All fish eat the eggs. There are a group of fish like green sunfish, catfish, bass, and trout, which will eat the tadpoles. And then catfish, bass, and trout will also eat the adults. So, I mean, they're hitting all the life cycles here. And that's why, in general, amphibians don't do real well, for the most part, when fish are around. We also have problems with introduced amphibians, like we've talked about before. Maybe, you know, again, introduce bullfrogs or cane toads or something like that. So our options here, one is you can go out and try to seine or electroshock or capture, like if they're like cane toads or American bullfrogs or African clawed frogs, go out there and try to capture them or gig them. Well, do you think we're ever going to eliminate them doing this, these techniques? You're going to get all the fish out by electroshocking or seining? In most cases, no. I mean, it's generally impossible to ensure that you've done that or remove all of an exotic amphibian that's been introduced. Might be fun doing that, I don't know, but you're probably not going to be that effective. So one thing is to drain it, as I mentioned. I guess I didn't have that up here, but the second thing to do that's effective is using rotenone. And rotenone should be applied in early fall or winter when you're doing it for amphibian conservation. And I think I have, yeah, here, rotenone as a conservation tool in amphibian rotenone as a conservation tool in amphibian conservation. This is just a little report. It's actually a long report, but I just printed off the discussion portion of it. This study that was done over in England. And that's the only place I know it's been done. It hasn't been published any other place, because I did a search this afternoon and nothing came up. So, but this is a possibility. Remove your fish. Why do we want to do it in early fall and winter? Because that's when you have the fewest number of tadpoles that are out there. Okay, you will have overwintering tadpoles. So, And those tadpoles will die, okay? The rotenone will kill tadpoles, all right? Now, one thing about rotenone, first of all, it's a natural chemical. I can't remember the chemical that's in rotenone, but it's from the roots of a South American plant. Fish folks probably know a heck of a lot more than I do about it. But one nice thing about it is that it breaks down rapidly. And it breaks down very fast when it's warm, okay? I mean, less than a week it'll break down when you have water temperatures up around 70, 80 degrees Fahrenheit. But during the winter, you're talking about months, usually about a month that it'll take to break down. You can also, after you've gone through a month, if you're still concerned about it, you can neutralize rotenone using potassium permanganate and applying that, which is a salt, which will neutralize. And the other thing, as far as applying rotenone, is you should do it in a closed system. That's how to maintain effectiveness, so your rotenone treated area, you know, the rotenone doesn't flow downstream or something like that. And also, as it does flow downstream on somebody else's property or whatever, you're going to be killing things until it gets diluted enough. So you want it want to do this in a closed system. Now you can, in small systems, small wetlands, you can accomplish it. I mean, we're talking wetlands maybe the size of this room that you can walk across. You can get it done just with using a backpack sprayer. You do need an applicator's permit, which you can get from, you get rotenone from pretty much any farmer's co-op. Fill out the paperwork necessary for the applicator's thing. You're supposed to wear, you know, protective gear. But in larger situations like this, you need to apply, you know, you need to use some type of pump. And so this pump is basically hooked up to the chemical, and it's pumping water from the lake through it. It mixes with the chemical, and then you spray it back out. And one of the suggestions that the folks over in Europe have is to ensure that you have really good penetration of rotenone is that with your shoreline vegetation, if you're planning on doing it, doing a rotenone kill, is you want to go through there with a bush hog, and you know, like cut your cattails down so that they're short, so that when that chemical hits, it actually penetrates deep down into that area, okay? Because you will have lots of juvenile fish that'll get up in that shoreline vegetation, and again, you want to have try to get a complete fish kill. So you should mow your shoreline vegetation, and there's bush hogs that'll actually reach out over the water with arms and hydraulic arms and stuff like that. And again, your overwintering tadpoles or larvae will die. Now, they were doing this for a newt population, and at least from their assessment, the adult newts were not negatively impacted. That, in my opinion, I would prefer to say we need to investigate this with a little more intensity. This is not a peer-refereed scientific article. And I wasn't able to find anything that looked at tadpole impacts when you apply rotenone. Or adults either, okay? So I think that needs to be investigated some more. All right, so I just put this up here more to indicate what level you want to, depending on an interest. When folks use rotenone, fisheries biologists use rotenone, they'll apply different concentrations depending on what species they want to hit, because some species are more sensitive than others. But for the most part, what we're talking about are this whole gamut here, going up to catfish and largemouth bass, which tend to have the greatest resilience to rotenone. So in most cases, you want to have the highest concentration, which is 2 to 3 parts per million. And that's basically what they use over in England, is this level, 2 to 3 parts per million. Now, what does that translate into is if you have a gallon of this rotenone liquid rotenone stuff, it's a 5% solution, is you can basically treat about an acre foot of water with one of those gallons. And they actually used 2 applications back to back. They did a December treatment, then a January treat, and make sure they had a complete fish kill, which you certainly could. And you could do November and then December. And if you want to make sure that was rotenone was completely gone, you could then follow it up a month later with potassium permanganate to make sure that anything that's there is neutralized. So by the time, you know, February comes along, when you start having January and February, you start having breeding amphibians, there aren't any negative impacts. So the other thing is obviously this is most effective if you're dealing with small systems. And I mean effective by killing the fish. You know, you start to get into larger, deeper systems, and it's just there's no reason even trying to control. So, you know, less than a hectare probably will have the most effective. All right.
Is there any concern about higher shelf development and the impact it has on that?
Well, higher trophic levels.
What about fish? You know, anything that's important about fish?
No, no. There has been quite a bit of research that's been done on that. And again, this is just from looking at fish and things eating fish that are kilothreatenone, and it's ungodly amounts of fish that they would have to eat for it to negatively impact. And even your dog drinking a roatenone treated pond, that it's some, like they have to drink 40 gallons of water. You know, so I mean, it's now I definitely wouldn't send any cattle down there because they will drink 40 gallons of water and fall over.
You know.
They do not recommend that. They do not recommend it. Yeah. So. Now, what else? What else? I guess that's about it. There's something else I was thinking of, but I forgot. Slipped my mind. All right. Well, I guess that's it. I guess that's as far as we're going to get, and so we will have lecture next Tuesday and finish things up.